I said I was going to introduce it. I'm glad you remembered that. Welcome back to Timber Sycamore's second series, Operation Condor. Today is episode 3, the infrastructure of Operation Condor. I am your host, Hayden DePriest.
And I am your co-host, Michael Petroselli.
You've been demoted to co-host.
I try to get demoted every week, and every week you keep making me do this.
We are bound by forces greater than ourselves, Michael, I'm afraid.
Yeah, we are.
Yeah, it's like, something about man making history, but not as he pleases, or, you know, something like that.
I was going with first as tragedy, second as farce. John Reed was the tragedy for the farce.
Yeah. Yeah, I do like positing Timber Sycamore as a great world historical event, however. I think that's adequate to describe what we are doing.
It's adequate to describe the amount of work I feel like I put in.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, indeed.
All right, so today we are going to talk about the infrastructure of Condor, right?
I already said that, but yeah, we are.
Cool. That's good.
Pulling up the PDF now. I had to restart my laptop just to get this to work. More proof that they're trying to shut us down, you know. F&A, man. They're there.
F&A, man, every time.
F&A, every time. Anyways, so when we talked about operating, we talked a little bit about this in the introductory episode to Condor, about this being a intelligence information bank between intelligence agencies in the United States and respective agencies in these Latin American countries.
Yes.
During the period of the operation. And so it's an intelligence sharing network ultimately, but also, you know, does carry out these various wet work operations.
Yeah. Which we're going to see a lot with a lot of the co-concurrent intelligence operations that are happening, is that there always has to be a legal cover, right?
Yes, there. Yes. Are you referring to Letellier in that case?
I was actually referring to Project Coast in South Africa.
I see.
Where they use legitimate businesses to cover up this wide-ranging chemical weapons and bioweapons program.
Mm-hmm. So as far as Operation Condor goes, it's probably pertinent for us to actually start with the inception of Operation Condor during the February 74 meeting. And we've touched on that in previous episodes, of course, but just to circle back to it.
Yes. So the 74 meeting is this kind of so the actual total of the 74 meeting is that it is 2/3 of the population of South Africa's, or blah, 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 blah. Fuck me. 2/3 of the population of South America's military is present there.
We are particularly overworked this week, so we apologize, but we'll make it through this.
Yeah. Argentina, Uruguay, Chile, Bolivia, Paraguay, and Brazil. This is called by Chile to oppose socialism.
Okay. And so because this happens in 74, this is post-73 coup in Chile.
Yes.
And Chile is arguably the most major player in South America at the time as far as, you know, setting up anti-communist, anti-socialist, nominatively anti-subversive operations in the continent.
We only have two sources on it at all. One is an intelligence officer who reported on it, and the other one is the U.S. ambassador. I was going to read a quote from the U.S. ambassador to Uruguay. The other one is the two documents that came out of it, one of which is just a schedule. And it's in response to something specific, which is this perception by Chile, who again are so at this point Manuel Contreras, Michael Townley says that he considers himself the capo of the anti-communist bloc.
Is that how you say that?
Capo?
Is it capo?
No, it's capo regime.
Oh, capo regime. I'm thinking capo like the thing you put on a guitar.
Oh, yeah, no, that's fair.
So the second document, what is that again?
So the second document is what Contreras said.
So it's a transcript of Contreras' actual, like, was it like a speech that was given, a lecture?
Yeah, so it's a copy from a FOIA'd CIA document. It says, subversion does not recognize border nor country, and its infiltration is penetrating every level of national life. Subversion has developed a leadership structure that is intercontinental, continental, regional, and subregional. As examples, we can list the Tricontinental Conference of Havana, the Revolutionary Coordinating Junta for South America, etc., all of which are given a pleasing face by all kinds of solidarity committees, congresses, tribunals, meetings, festivals, and conferences, etc. In contrast, the countries that are being attacked on the military, economic, and political front from both inside and outside their borders are fighting back at most only with bilateral understandings or simple gentlemen's agreements. We recommend the utilization of liaison resources outside the countries of the system, especially those that are outside the continent, to obtain information on subversion.
Mm-hmm.
So that last section there is particularly interesting because the U.S. is only present as an observer at this meeting, right?
Right.
They're not there to be part of an intelligence network.
Not a pure information sharing bank, no.
Well, and even then, like, they would probably be openly willing to participate in an American open information sharing bank. They participate mm-hmm. in Five Eyes. They're more than willing to do that.
Especially given that the geopolitical interests that the United States would have in the region at this time and throughout history, just speaking very generally.
Right. The fact that they didn't jump on it almost immediately is maybe the more concerning part, right?
Well, only concerning insofar as they have a different infrastructure, a different kind of organization in mind.
Yes. So the first phase is what is termed by John Dinges as non-operational, which means that it is strictly information gathering. So there was a previous operation that was done, which is where we kind of get the idea for this,
mm-hmm.
Which was a joint Argentine-Chilean-Uruguayan operation to capture two communists. So it's important to remember here that because this very quickly becomes transnational, you'll remember last time we talked about refugees from the countries that had these earlier coups fleeing to the ones that haven't had them yet, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when your country's intelligence agency is now allowed to operate in the country that you are a refugee in, you lose all of the benefits of refugee status.
Right. And so this becomes a particular issue for... Is it Horman and Tarugi?
Yes.
Okay. And it's the issue of claiming political asylum and respecting the sanctity of political asylum.
To some degree?
Yes.
Yeah. And Manuel Contreras, he's a real forward thinker in terms of, like, willingness to violate national boundaries.
Okay. How's that?
So in his country that is not a superpower, because superpowers do this routinely, right? Because they have the ability to. They exist in a near permanent state of exception.
Mm-hmm.
When you're a third world or developing country, that gets a little dicier, especially when you want to operate in superpowers territory. So Colonel Jose Fons, the chief of Uruguay's delegation, in a meeting 26 years later, said, Chile proposed operations to eliminate enemies all over the world, to eliminate people who were causing harm to our countries, people like Letelier. That was an operation that required a lot of preparation. A very well done operation. Chile had the resources and the will to operate. I repeat, Chile had the resources to operate.
So Chile really is the bulwark of this meeting then.
Yeah.
So what's interesting is that, like, again, and we're going to get a little bit into the actual... So episode 4, we're still doing the Argentine dirty war, correct?
Yes.
So as far as that goes, we're going to get a little bit more into the actual, like, position of someone like Juan Perón, it's a rather convoluted mess, but ultimately this is, like, I believe the meeting where that Juan Perón is in attendance for, where he authorizes the Argentine Federal Police and Argentine Intelligence to cooperate with Chilean intelligence in apprehending Chilean left-wing extremists, quote-unquote, that were in exile in Argentina specifically at the time. Now, Chilean left-wing extremists, and again, this actually comes up during Letelier Moffat as well, extremists nominatively, I should say. These are essentially, like, former supporters or employed politicians under the Allende government.
Yeah, in Letelier's case, it would be like if George Bush had shot Al Gore.
Yeah, that's one way to say it.
Or I guess more accurately, like if Clinton had shot Gore.
If Clinton had...
Because they ran against each other. So, like, it would be similar to that, in that they were, like, nominally opposed, but really they were on the same side for the majority of this.
Yep. Letelier, you're... Sorry. What is the contention on what happened to Letelier then?
Letelier would be, like, similar to a Gore-type figure in opposition to Pinochet. Like, where he was, like...
And Pinochet is Clinton in this scenario?
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
They also both call themselves neoliberals, so they have that selling point.
I mean, yeah. Fair enough. That being said, Letelier, Orlando Letelier, was actually, again... the victim of an assassination in Washington, D.C. in 1976 that was carried out by operatives from the Chilean intelligence agency, DINA.
Yes. He was also previously the ambassador to Washington for Pinochet. So there's something... that goes strangely, which is Kissinger sends a cable to ambassadors during phase two, which we're now kind of entering, which is this. So Dinges says that operations are what separate the men from the boys in intelligence.
This is not correct.
What?
Orlando Letelier did not work for Pinochet.
Yes, he did.
That's not what I'm seeing. In the coup d'etat of 11 September 73, he was the first high-ranking member of the Allende administration to be arrested. He was held for 12 months in various concentration camps and suffered severe torture. Highly critical, wrote several articles criticizing the Chicago Boys.
Sorry, he was foreign minister and defense minister in Allende's got to Washington, D.C.
Yes. So
yeah.
He did not work for Pinochet.
No. Okay. We're going to cut that.
Well, how do we... What do you mean we're going to cut it?
Yeah, no, we can't. You're right. I just have to learn how to read. That'll be good.
Where did you read that he was a...
No, Pinochet? I literally... It was just Pinochet and Allende's name were next to each other in the line.
Oh, wow.
It was...
That's how pressed for time we are.
It was... He was the most vocal outside opposition to Pinochet, Allende's former foreign minister and defense minister.
Oh, wow. You really fucked up.
And I just said... Okay, yeah, Pinochet's for...
yeah, no, so Letelier, again, like, what I had read was that he was a politician and very prominently an economist under Salvador Allende.
Yes. Did Bernardo Leighton used to work with the Pinochet government?
I have no idea. We need fact checkers. Let's talk a little bit more about Orlando Letelier specifically, just as one of the... I mean, we could talk about Horman and Tarugi as well, or we could talk about Michelini and Gutierrez. Those are all the principal examples I found of, like, these kinds of assassination operations that had happened. One of the most... Michelini and Gutierrez is one of the more interesting ones.
Yeah, for sure. The kind of internal assassinations within the Condor countries, the U.S. is pretty much just willing to ignore. Mm-hmm. When that becomes an issue is when all of a sudden there has to be a response from the U.S. So there's an official cable from Kissinger to the Department of State representatives who says government planned and directed assassinations within and outside the territory of Condor members has most serious implications, which we must squarely and rapidly face. Obviously, that gets ignored, which is not the kind of thing that normally happens to Henry Kissinger.
No, not at all.
Which means that either Kissinger was ignored because he did not intend to have his instructions followed, or the entire Department of State just decided to violate the head of Department of State's orders.
Which does not tend to be the case for the majority of Kissinger's career. He's actually decently good at commanding authority.
Yeah, he's terrifying.
To put it lightly.
So where this becomes a real issue is that as we learn about the planned assassination of Letelier before it even happens, correct, you know, during the FBI investigation, they also document evidence that the Chileans who carried out the assassination used Condor to obtain passports and visas. So Hewson Ryan is troubled by this, and he expresses his concern. And then ultimately, Hewson Ryan gets a notice from George H.W. Bush.
Oh, F&A man. Okay, what's he got to say?
That Hewson Ryan should be deeply concerned about the fact that he may be have an assassination attempt committed against him.
Uh-oh.
But the U.S. doesn't really do anything about it. They just, like, let him know.
Is that a lot like, again, that seems very par for the course. That seemed to be the issue with Nord Stream as well, where they were just constantly telling Europe, you know. It's a mafioso tactic. Telling Houston Ryan it would really be a shame if you got whacked.
Right, yeah. Wouldn't it be so sad if, some Chilean dude shot you in the fucking head while you were trying to go to bed tomorrow night? Yeah, that'd be sad. I'd be really bummed out about it. You should be careful. And to some extent, I guess, like, someone like George Bush does not have to let him know that. And in fact, likely would not let him know that, depending on the circumstances, probably. But the plan behind this is that formal cooperation is needed, but the CIA and FBI are already contributing to this data bank, right? Because this is supposed to be on subversives.
Oh, yeah. We have a lot of... There's actually some very interesting examples of that later on. That's where... That's Horman and Tarugi for one, and then Michelini Gutierrez for another. Two examples of interesting connections, potentially, to, like... CIA specifically information gathering.
And also, we're at the height of COINTELPRO. Well, I guess we're a little bit past COINTELPRO. Both are contributing to the data bank.
What is the name of this data bank? Because that's COINTELPRO's FBI, right?
Yeah. It's literally, that is what Operation Condor was this time. We were internationally cooperating with a data bank in the same way that we do with Five Eyes.
Right. And so, again, you think that the general structure of COINTELPRO was to some degree imported, or?
I think that
the lessons learned.
Yeah, they certainly used some of the tactics that the FBI uses, specifically like the constant harassment, the like overt threats that J. Edgar Hoover used to make, right?
Mm-hmm.
We kind of see those mirrored later in Bolivia during the cocaine coup.
Which ordinarily we would be all in favor of, but not this one.
Yeah. He stands in front of the national television and he says that anyone opposed to the government should have to walk around with their last will and testament under their arm.
Again, not really necessary if the government that you are, you know, protesting is a right-wing neo-fascist dictatorship, because last will and testament, you don't own anything.
Yeah, right. You can will your debt to people, I guess.
Yeah. I don't have a will.
Yeah, me neither.
Yeah, we don't own anything.
So phase two and three are the... Oops, sorry.
I was going to say, all my books are just going to, I don't know, send them to a library. Send them to public schools kids. They, you know,
why?
They,
so they can throw them in the trash? They're not taking your books.
Why? Why not? Well, the kids don't want to read Epictetus.
They won't let libraries put fucking the mouse book about the Holocaust on the shelf. And you think they're letting them put Freud's sexuality books on the shelf?
Okay. They should. When I was in high school, yeah. I read a biography of Andy Warhol that had a very detailed description of like the oral sex acts that he used to perform on people and have performed on him. I was 15 years old and I was just like thinking to myself, wow, they don't actually read the books that they get.
Yeah, I'm sure that most of them
I mean,
them
no
don't.
One has time to read them all, but... You
yeah,
know,
it's only when, like, parents pitch a fit.
Yeah, pitch a hissy fit. Like, you know, I'm all in favor of the Andy Warhol sex book being in schools. It was a biography. The man fucked. What do you want us to do?
Right, me. My kids. They'll be raised with a copy of Che Guevara's biography in their hand, because I'm a good red pepper emoji.
Yeah.
Just kidding. They're going to have to read Les Mis by the time they're four.
Okay. That's unironically way worse, I'll be honest.
It's unironically way better.
Oh, my God. And they make fun of me for being the French guy on the podcast. Look at this asshole.
So, as we enter phase two and three, we enter the operations phase. So, all of the operations that take place in Condor are black, because officially, Condor is just a data bank.
All of the ops are black.
Yeah.
They're black ops.
Yes. I'm not giving into this joke. I know what you're trying to do. You're not going to trick me.
I'm not. That's... No. You are so... So paranoid. You're so... You've got such a persecution complex, Mike.
I do.
Yeah. Which is crazy because you are... I remember last night when we had the problems with the stream, you were telling me... After failing to... try the solution of a different laptop, or you continue to insist that I was trying to sabotage you to my own detriment.
Yeah. It's fucking A-Man, though. I know who it is.
Yeah. It's always fucking A-Man.
So the things that they were going to do was disseminating black propaganda, which is lies or disinformation to discredit or confound the enemy. Surveillance of the location of enemy targets, and covert missions to capture and hold enemy activists. So, yeah, that's really what defined phase two, is that it was this move towards operations and away from strictly being a training and information gathering position, right? In phase one, we are just figuring out where our enemies are, and now in phase two, we're beginning to move against them.
From theory to praxis, one might say.
Yes. The problem in phase two is that it's limited, right? Phase two can only touch certain countries. This is where the model comes in. And I'm sorry, earlier I said it was Uruguay. It is Paraguay. Chile, Argentina, and Paraguay, before the November meeting, arrest a Chilean and an Argentine arriving from Argentina. They're on the first stop of a mission to several different Latin American countries, and they're part of the JCR. Paraguay permits Chile to transport them to a clandestine location in Chile. There, they are held for 4 more months, and then they disappear.
Where do they go?
Either to the Andes, the ocean, or Rio de la Plata.
Not to the Rio Grande.
No, not to the Rio Grande.
We've already recorded these episodes. We actually have to re-record them, so that's what we're referencing. We're happy.
It's been that was last time.
Was it last time?
Yeah.
Oh shit.
So knowing that this information is obtained under torture, which should make it illegal for the U.S. to use at all, the FBI shares and distributes this intelligence anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So phase two is a formalization of this kind of behavior.
Whereas in phase one, this kind of behavior happens a little bit more, not sporadically, but without formalization.
Yeah, or not as coordinated. Yeah, it's not as coordinated. It's usually done within your own state. You're not doing it in other Operation Condor states.
Yeah, it's not formal. It's a business casual.
Yeah. Torture becomes an inevitable and integral part of the process, according to John Dinges. I'm going to say his name differently every single time I say it, probably. I'm going to be honest. Dinges, Dinges. So basically how it works is they exchange information, keeping track of whereabouts and movements. Then you carry out the surveillance and capture. And then all interested parties are allowed to participate in the interrogation. Upon request, a captured leftist would be transported to his or her home for further interrogation and eventually execution.
So any interested parties were allowed to participate in these enhanced interrogations?
Yeah.
It was a gang interrogation?
Yeah, they had usually all involved countries would be there because they share certain facilities. So because they are shared facilities, it is fairly easy to just pop in on the person who is also at that facility. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So this is all of phase two. And then phase three, we begin to move externally.
So we're moving to countries that are not actually, like, all of the countries that are involved in Operation Condor are more or less consenting to having these sorts of operations conducted within their borders. Phase three, we're moving to outside of those agreed countries. This is now this is essentially a terrorist network.
Yes. Letellier is the most typical type of victim. He's targeted as a dangerous Democrat rather than a violent terrorist. So what's interesting is that this is in stark contrast to everything else we hear. The U.S. ambassador to Uruguay, Ernest Siracusa, writes to Washington July 20th, 1976, that these nations face a regional, coordinated terrorist threat is fact, not fiction. The most rational approach to deal with a coordinated regional enemy is to organize along similar lines. The U.S. has long urged these countries to increase their cooperation for security. Now that they are doing so, our reaction should not be one of opprobrium.
And so that Letellier is not what. So go ahead.
That is not what was happening.
Okay, what was happening?
They were targeting people like Letellier, people who were otherwise liberal Democrats, people who were typified by having at one point been a member of a party that was in soft opposition to Pinochet. They weren't like the same people who were joining, I don't know, communist parties, for example.
So Letellier was a very vocal critic of Pinochet, though.
And a very effective one. And that is his main threat.
Letellier also was in contact with the like exiled Chilean government in East Berlin.
Yes. He has access to. So he's identified because, quote, he doesn't work against us in secret. He works against us in public corridors of power in the United States and Europe.
Who's he?
Letelier.
He works in the... He doesn't work in secret. He works in the open.
Yeah. Yeah, specifically because
point,
he...
The point being...
Specifically because he is nonviolent and because he is this kind of liberal Democrat, he operates on... He's a different kind of threat. He's appealing. He can get civil rights organizations against you. He can get human rights organizations against you. Right? When they're just gunning down communists, outside of their countries, people are kind of willing to look the other way.
Mm-hmm. But within the country, not so much.
Yeah, right. Within the Condor countries, people were going into mass uprisings, and those have to be put down, right? These are wildly unpopular leaders. None of them are elected. Most of them overthrow a democratically elected leader. You know, there are exceptions, but the back-to-back coup artists, I guess, were honestly sometimes a little less unpopular just because the preceding government was so wildly unpopular that people were like, well, I guess you're better. Then comes forward a plan to kill Congressman Ed Koch. And Condor, during all of this, is still being hidden as a data bank.
When is Condor actually fully declassified?
So most of the documents we have Most of the documents we have now from it are exclusively from the Argentine Dirty War.
Was it the CIA that declassified documents related to the Argentine Dirty War, or was it Argentina?
It was us. Senate and Congress made them. It became like a huge blow up nationally, particularly because of... So it becomes public that there are mass arrests, secret prisons, concentration camps, extermination methods, and crematoriums, which are comparable with the worst practices of the Nazi era. It's overt. Like, it was, by the end, not a secret. Especially the Argentine Dirty War, right? Like the rest of them, especially Pinochet, he becomes this kind of anti-communist icon.
Legendary, yeah.
But you don't see anyone be like, oh yeah, I really associate with Videla. Because Videla, honestly, is much more brutal than Pinochet.
Maybe slightly less ideological. You're not getting this kind of like massive monetarist experiment in Argentina as you are in Chile. You are getting this massive, like, not like the massive kind of like almost akin to like a social or cultural like revolution, even if it was counter-revolution or if it was induced by powers that were hostile or acting in bad faith. Like, Argentina just kind of doesn't have anything that you can even point to like that. It is just political repression. It's not even...
Yeah. And it's ideological, but in a very different way, right? Like, it's very religiously oriented. It's very much focused on, we are a Christian nation. We are a Catholic nation specifically. Worship the Pope.
It's not really integralist yet, though, is it?
So, they would probably identify as self-identify as integralist. Their motto for their military at this point is going into battle with sword and cross.
Okay.
In Allende's election, democracy had power to bring a Marxist proclaiming he would create a unique and peaceful Chilean road to socialism, right? There's a signal that is sent. Kissinger and Nixon decide that they are going to make a statement. The U.S. will back, the most brutal and vicious extreme rightists, as long as capitalism is maintained in ideological warfare. Internationally illegal operation tactics are fine. And then September 16th, 1970, Richard Helms sends a letter. President Richard Nixon has decided that Nyende regime is not acceptable to the United States. The presidency has asked the agency to prevent Allende from coming to power and to unseat him and authorized $10 million for this purpose. We will establish a special task force to carry out this mandate. Preliminary plans will be discussed with Dr. Kissinger on September 18th, 1970.
It's moments like these that I think it's pertinent for us to discuss and to properly delineate the difference between operations that are CIA-backed and operations that are actually not CIA-backed. They are CIA-orchestrated.
Yes.
This is not like, you know, there's this cool guy Pinochet who looks like he could take power. We should give him some money. We are actively trying to overthrow a democracy. Personally.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what we're doing. We send $35,000 to one of the guys who kidnaps the head of the... He kidnaps General René Schneider, who opposes Allende, but follows the law, which is that the army is there to protect the Constitution. Mm-hmm. He follows that law. That is all he does. He opposes the coup, not because he believes in Allende, but because he believes in the country having democracy. He is kidnapped and murdered. The U.S. government sent $35,000 to his kidnapper. The U.S. insists that it was not for that. They say that it was to keep prior contact with him secret, maintain goodwill, and, quote, for humanitarian reasons.
Humanitarian reasons.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's a...
Yeah, we're going to eliminate the purpose of refugee status so that we for humanitarian reasons. Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
So there's an interesting structure to Operation Condor outside of the country as well. And outside of the U.S., right? Because we have these ties to NATO. We talked about the SOA last time, but it's also worth talking about the French École de Guerre, which takes a bunch of specifically Argentine soldiers. I know I said that wrong.
No, you didn't. You didn't say it super wrong. It's just I'm laughing at the name.
Oh yeah, the School of War.
Well, you know, Nyusha was always telling me whenever I was talking to some of these French girls online that they're just very upfront and they're very upfront with their desires and Watson. It's like part of the French personality, I suppose. School of War. It's just very upfront.
Yeah. Yeah. They're super direct. And what they train everyone in is the same tactics that the French learned in Algeria.
Very nice. Very cool.
They're actually shown the movie The Dirty War as part of their training, which at the time is banned in France, right? Like, you are not allowed to watch this if you are a French citizen, but when we are training international terrorists, you have to watch them. The U.S. government also watched it to prepare for the war in Iraq.
The Dirty War? What movie is this?
Oh, fuck me. Battle of Algiers.
Oh my god.
So, on the one hand, we have the École de Guerre, which is training these kinds of Argentine terrorists. We also have international funding and international backing by longtime ideological anti-communists, right? Mm-hmm. So, at the same time as Condor is beginning, we are seeing the years of lead in Italy at their peak. The results of the years of lead are in part that Junio Borghese carries out the Borghese coup, and it fails. Mm-hmm. In the aftermath of this, there's a man named Michele Della Calle, or Stefano Della Calle. Stefano Della Calle. Stefano goes to first Spain and then ultimately Ireland because of his contacts in Spain sending him there, where he meets up with someone strange. That is Otto Skorzeny.
Oh. Okay. Where's this going?
So Otto Skorzeny is, for anyone who doesn't know, a highly decorated World War II veteran. He's involved in Operation Greif.
He's a highly decorated World War II veteran. That's yeah. Just like my grandpa. Are you doing a joke, or are you actually just not met?
I'm getting there.
Okay, go ahead.
I was building to it.
All right.
So he begins his career as a civil engineer, and then takes part in the invasion of the Soviet Union with the SS Division Das Reich.
So Otto Skorzeny was a Nazi.
Yeah.
That's what I'm going with this.
Yeah, he famously helps free Mussolini in the Grand Sasso raid, which any account of reads like an absolutely insane person designed it. So the plan is that they are going to take gliders, carrying 9 soldiers and a pilot, and they're going to land and go save Mussolini.
So, did they save Mussolini?
Yeah, they did.
Oh, cool.
But it's still very, very stupid.
Scorsese, was that one of the Nazis that ended up working for Mossad?
Yes, he does.
Okay, so this guy is all over the place, it seems like.
Post-war, he is involved with Naguib in Egypt. He works with Richard Galen. He has this like rotating group of Nazis who constantly are around him. He acts as an advisor to Perón for a little bit, so he's already known in Argentina. And he's really building towards this idea of a Fourth Reich. He's super into it. He gets involved with Simon Wiesenthal. Who, of course, is a Nazi hunter, and he agrees to help Wiesenthal if he gets removed from the list. He ultimately assassinates Heinz Krug, a German rocket scientist for Mossad. And then finally, he's declared denazified in absentia.
What does that mean?
So normally, to be denazified, you would have had to prove that you, like, ideally... Well, so the system, the way it was supposed to work is you serve your time. When you come out, you are either declared denazified or not denazified, depending on whether you showed actual contrition for your crimes.
If you're not denazified, do they still let you out?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess, yeah, that makes sense. But it's like, so what does denazified mean? Like, how does
In this case, literally nothing. Because like, Skorzeny...
Are there any consequences to pay if you're not denazified?
So he's now allowed to leave Spain. Like he was trapped in Spain, hanging out in Madrid.
Wait, so if you're nazified, you have to stay in Spain?
Yeah. Or in other fascist countries that aren't complying with the
NATO rules. Okay, so if you're not denazified, then you're just banned from all countries, except the ones that don't care. Or that would or that would want to recruit you.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Which is a shocking amount of the world at this point.
So how many countries... I don't want to get on a tangent, but I'm just curious. So if I'm still... Let's say that I'm Nazified, right? I leave, right. I serve my time, but I'm still just a hardcore raging Nazi. Where can I go? Portugal and Spain, obviously.
You've been denazified now?
No, I'm not denazified. I'm still Nazified.
Portugal, Spain. So this is 52 that he's declared denazified. So you still have Greece. You still have... parts of Latin America. A bunch of them head to South Africa. And some of them hang out in the Middle East as, like, military advisors.
Mm-hmm.
So
is that true, though, about all those Nazis going to Argentina? Were you allowed to go to Argentina?
Yeah, Perón takes a bunch of them in.
Wow, the left really loves this guy.
Including the butcher of Lyon, Klaus Barbie, who is still here at the time when this all goes down. Just hanging out, doing his thing, acting as a military enforcer for cocaine runners.
Oh, wow. They went everywhere. Well, obviously, you know, very famously, we've teased talking about Operation Paperclip, but that was one place you could go as a Nazi if you proved useful enough.
Yes. Operation Paperclip brought people to the U.S. There are some who go to Canada, England. It depended on what skill set you had specifically. Mm-hmm. Also on how well connected you were. Did you get a fake passport? If you could get yourself a fake passport, things went a little bit better for you. The rat lines, they run people to Paraguay, Colombia, Brazil, Uruguay, Mexico, Chile, Peru, Guatemala, Ecuador, Bolivia, the U.S., Spain, Switzerland.
So not Portugal. How about that?
Yes, but only because the Vatican was officially opposed to the party, and they were definitely integralist at this point.
Oh, integralist. Okay. But they went to... Okay, yeah, that's fine. You know what?
Well, it depends on if you're, like, a true believer or, like, if you're only, like, an integralist as, like, a talking point, right?
You're only in it for the, yeah, to get that sweet integralist clout.
That said, they are mostly brought through the Vatican anyway, specifically because there is an Argentine cardinal who is helping them all escape.
Big L for Catholics, my friend.
Yeah. Charles Le Scott also is helped to escape through that.
I just necked myself for the actions of the Catholic Church.
I don't punish myself for them anymore. I've given up on that for a long time.
That's punishing yourself is like that is essential for being a Catholic.
Yeah, I just found new things to punish myself with.
Yeah. Well, you know, just as long as you're punishing yourself. Don't punish me any longer.
The Franciscans are heavily involved with this because there's a Bosnian Croat who is the head of, who is the leader of this group within the Franciscan order, tied to Austria, but also like helping the Ustasta escape. Ustasha. I hate Eastern European languages.
Why?
Because they suck.
They don't. They're cool.
So Draganovich runs this rat line that's an open secret amongst intelligence. The U.S. State Department lists 9 war criminals plus others, quote, not actually sheltered in the Collegium Illyricum, but who otherwise enjoy his protection and support.
Mm-hmm.
CIC Special Agent Robert Clayton Mudd goes in and says that the monastery that he runs is, quote, honeycombed with cells of Ustasha operatives. The U.S. to this day insists that rat lines were a myth, that they did not happen.
But why would, okay, like rat lines to the United States or just in general?
Both, kind of, but specifically to the United States. But they also argue that if they happened, the U.S. definitely did not know about them.
Just in, Eichmann, though. Very famously.
Yes.
So the idea is that he didn't use a rat line. It was all independent.
So all of these dudes who are in Latin America are all hanging out with Michael Townley, who is a CIA agent.
Yeah.
They're working for the Galen organization.
Well, you said rat lines in general. So it's like to disqualify the possibility of United States involvement in rat lines is one thing. But to suggest that there was no infrastructure in place to facilitate the flow of Nazi war criminals into Latin America when they are clearly all hanging out here at the same time for whatever particular reason is bizarre.
Well, it's also just untrue. Like, Operation Bloodstone is the most obvious example, which is where they go and try to find Nazi collaborators living in Soviet-backed areas to work undercover for U.S. intelligence.
I mean,
most of them are high-ranking ex-Nazi intel.
It's provably untrue with, like, sufficient evidence, but, like, it's also, like, just very clearly, intuitively untrue if you just look at the... It's like I said, to claim that there is no infrastructure in place at all when they're just all there is completely fucking A-man claims whatever he wants.
Yeah, they all just showed up there on their own.
This is ridiculous.
Funny enough, I found out that there is a group called the German Marshall Fund who published an article the other day about how parapolitical websites are the largest disseminators of misinformation in America.
Do they use the phrase parapolitical?
Yes.
Wow. We're going places, guys.
They are also... The German Marshall Fund is named after the Marshall Plan.
Nice.
Which they have a whole write-up on their website praising. It's hilarious. I had a great time reading it.
And so we are the biggest spreaders of disinformation on the internet, right, today?
Yes.
Okay.
So by the end of this, we have Skorzeny, who's at the time running Paladin, which is a military contractor that he runs out of Spain, but he lives in Ireland because he's no longer forced to stay in Spain. Klaus Barbie is in Bolivia helping General Garcia Meza. He is tied to Skorzeny. Michael Townley is all over the place. We'll see him in Argentina and Chile and Bolivia. He's everywhere. He's a CIA agent who kind of walks circles with all of these guys. And then we also have Pagliai down there with him, who's another guy who carries out bombings in Italy with him with Della Chiaia during the years of lead. Della Chiaia shows up after the Borghese coup fails. And then, as this happens, Della Chiaia, Barbie, and Michael Townley decide that they're going to go into business together.
All right. What are they doing?
They run a narco-terror... I don't know if I should call them... They're like narco-defense contractors.
Okay.
If Eric Prince lived in Bolivia and it was illegal for him to operate because he only defended narco-terrorists. Okay. Like, they specialize in defending cocaine distribution networks.
The Eric Prince of cocaine.
Yeah, and they call their group the Fiancés of Death, which is an old Spanish international brigade marching him. Mm-hmm. So all of this gets questioned about later, which we'll see during the Contra situation that comes up. The expert witness who gets called during that is also present in Latin America at this time. His last name is Leiden. And he is a friend of Oliver North and a P2 associate.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God. So, sorry. He's a friend of Oliver North and a P2
associate. Yeah, so he has no vested interest in any of this.
The fucking way everything... It's all crossing... everything that we've ever talked about is all crossing together all at once.
Yeah, they do a very bad job.
Is he also Mujahideen?
He should be. Fucking guy.
Yeah, convert to Islam, please.
Is Oliver North Mujahideen?
Oh, I certainly hope so.
I feel like he's honorary Muj at this point.
He's honorary. We're not allowed to say that word on the podcast anymore.
That's true. I feel like he's honorary Mujahideen at this point.
I mean, nobody, they don't, like, our bosses don't listen to this, so we're basically independent. Fuck it.
He... Honestly, Oliver North's life is insane. We could do a whole episode just on Oliver North at some point.
Yeah, he's still alive. We could interview him.
I don't think he would do an interview with us.
Oh, ye of little faith.
Oh, I wouldn't do an interview with us if I was him.
I would. Yeah, can we interview MIA at least?
Like Mia? The rapper?
Yeah. Well, she's woke now.
Well, she's always been like kind of political. Like, I know that she was slandered for a long time because she was pro-Palestine.
Slandered by who?
Like mainstream press at the time.
Oh, mainstream press. I wonder who owns those. I'm kidding. That's a joke. We like to have fun here. We didn't actually get to, I think it's about time that we wrap this up. We didn't actually get to the most horrific story that you told me last time we tried to record this.
Which was?
Oh, the dogs.
Oh, so, for anyone who has seen the promotional materials that I have made that Hayes hates.
I don't hate them. I would like my own chance to work on them because Michael uses weirdo, random, like, subscription programs that he uses for emails for to like make these. I don't know. I'm a classic guy. I like Photoshop.
In the picture with eight people on it, there's a woman in the bottom right corner. You can't really tell that she is a woman. She was one of Pinochet's torturers. She ran a, or she's not one of Pinochet's torturers. She is an Argentine torturer, I believe.
Oh, she's one of Perón's torturers. Not Perón, of course, but the national reorganization. Yeah, we'll get to who took over after Perón.
Nope, she was Chilean. Ingrid Olderbach.
Okay.
I have her my notes on her here.
Oh, famous Chilean name, Ingrid Olderbach.
So, she is actually probably less... She would be offended if you called her Chilean, actually. So she's raised in a... family with a fascist father. She has contempt for Latin culture and calls it prone to disorder. She's only allowed to speak German at home growing up. And in an interview, she says, I have been a Nazi since I was a child, since I learned that the best period that Germany lived was when the Nazis were in power, when there was work and tranquility and there were no shameless thieves. She joins Dino with the rank of captain. She comes out of the women's school of the institution, which is a very dumb name. But around 70 women are instructed in torture there. She learns secrets related to Project Andrea, which we will get into during the Chile episodes. And she runs this detention center called Venda Sexy. Which... is supposed to be named ironically. It's called Sexy Blindfold for anyone who doesn't speak Spanish. She has this dog that she trains. And it's a special dog. It's a dog that is trained to torture and rape. Mm-hmm. And it is named Volodya. Volodya is the name of a communist who had to flee Chile. Again, she's big on jokes. She routinely has her dog rape women and occasionally men, I suppose. Although there's nothing like specific about it being done to men. Mm-hmm. But I assume that once you have a dog trained to rape people, you are kind of free to use that.
Yeah. Barbaric and bizarre, ultimately.
Yeah, ultimately they hold 80 inmates under her.
Suddenly, Salo is not so much of an exaggeration or pointless movie. Shit like that was just happening.
Yeah, no, he was accurately describing the situation in these fascist countries. And I mean, Contreras is no better, and we'll see. Like, Miguel Contreras is the, like, beating heart and soul of Dinah.
Join us next time for episode 4 about the Argentine Dirty War, where we get into more of this, and we are not going to spoil it anymore because we want to keep that content nice and fresh.
Yeah, and we'll get to talk about drug traffickers, DEA agents, and violence.
All right. From all of us here at Timber Sycamore, I'm Hayden DePriest.
And I am Michael Petruselli.
Thank you so much for tuning in.